WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After a career that started at the end of World War II as a midshipman and ended in 1989 as the top-ranking officer in the American military, my guest, Admiral William Crowe, has written his memoirs. His new book is called In the Line of Fire. Admiral Crowe was appointed chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff by President Reagan. He retired in 1989 in spite of the fact that President Bush asked him to stay on. But in the last election, Crowe endorsed Bill Clinton. Earlier today, I asked Crowe if that ended his relationship with George Bush. He told me that would be for Bush to say, but possibly. Crowe hasn't spoken to Bush since the election. Now Crowe chairs President Clinton's new Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. I asked Admiral Crowe about President Clinton's troubled relations with the military.
He has a problem with the military, however. You know, once you serve 47 years, you don't see anything new. All you see are things just coming up time and again. There's a strong tendency in the press to use rather inflated adjectives. But this is by no means the first time in my experience when the military has not been too satisfied with their commander-in-chief. I even saw that with Roosevelt. Despite his success in the war, and particularly when he started drawing down the military after the war, I saw it in spades with Truman and the Secretary of Defense, Lewis Johnson, when the military was absolutely felt they'd been double-crossed and were livid by the dramatic cuts made in that administration, which we suffered from very badly in the first days of Korea. Kennedy brought in Mr. McNamara, Secretary of Defense, and put in operations analysis, which irritated the military no end, and the relationship there was anything but good. Under Jimmy Carter at the end of Vietnam, and when he drew down after Vietnam, well, the military was quite upset. So what I'm seeing with Clinton is neither new nor is it as intense as some other things I've seen in the past in my own experience. It's almost inevitable, though, when a president starts compressing funds, and drawing down and shrinking, that he is going to encounter opposition, resistance, and criticism.
Let me ask you about gays in the military. You have said that the arguments against gays are generated more by emotion than reason.
I don't know that I said they were generated more, but I certainly say that some of them are generated by emotion.
Is this a challenge you would have welcomed during the period that you were head of the Joint Chiefs?
Certainly not. No, uh-huh. Not at all.
Why not?
Of course, one of my major objections to this problem, which I expressed to the president during the campaign, is the timing. It's a very, very poor time, given all the things that are happening to the military. What I would really like, of course, is for both sides in this argument to back off a little bit. The gays are very shrill, and the people on the other end of the spectrum are very emotional. I look at it not as whether I'm for or against it. I look at it from the standpoint of whoever makes the decision when all the smoke settles. And I think it's too early to jump on this argument as saying yes or no. For example, the military is engaged in a big study for the Secretary of Defense saying how they think this should be handled and some of their suggestions. Secretary Aspin has commissioned the RAND Corporation to study this problem and report back to him, and Senator Nunn is conducting hearings. Now, whoever makes that decision shouldn't make it till he's seen all this. There are going to be some imaginative suggestions come out of all this, and I imagine even more. And we're going to be more enlightened when this is all over. So I wish people would just bide their time and keep an open mind for a while these things are completed.
So have you made your conclusion yet, or are you waiting to see all the studies?
No, I'm sort of biding my time. Uh-huh. I have an open mind, and many people criticize me for having an open mind. I also do believe, however, that the more dramatic statements that bringing gays in the military will destroy the U.S. military, I think that's nonsense. Our leadership is too good. Our military is too good. And incidentally, same claims were made when we brought in minorities, when we brought in women. And we're not going to let a few gays destroy our military. We're not going to let them erode our effectiveness. We're not going to let them us not have the best military. But we can handle that. That's the name of our game. That's what we do. We're leaders.
When you were commanding, did you ever know of men who were gay serving under you?
I have served in a unit where we thought there were some gays, but we had no evidence of that. But they served very well, and as a matter of fact, on the ship I was on, a small submarine, they were very well liked, and they were extremely competent.
Did you ever try to find out information to verify if they were gay so that you could get rid of them if they were?
No, I did not. I saw no reason to get rid of them. They were performing extremely well, and they were trusted by the crew, and their relationship with the crew and the officers, and the ship was good.
Now, were you violating policy by not investigating them further and trying to get rid of them if they were gay?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Do a lot of officers do that?
Our policy was not to conduct a witch hunt every time we saw somebody that sort of dangerous to go on preliminary evidence into a witch hunt.
Okay. So, just to wrap up the section, so you're waiting for more information before
yes,
you decide where you stand.
I think to make a decision before the Senator Nunn's hearings, that's what he's doing. He's trying to decide where the weight of evidence lies. And, but I want to stress the point that while it may be more complicated and it may be more difficult to operate with gays, you've got a good military, and we can do things that we have to do. And the idea that we have no problems with heterosexuals but gays would cause us all kinds of problems is not right either. I've spent a lifetime solving problems for traditional WASP heterosexuals, and that's what the military does day to day.
One other policy question, and then I want to talk more about your career in the military. The NATO forces have just started to enforce the ban of Serbian planes over Bosnia.
The no-fly zone.
The no-fly zone. And then there was the report by experts to the Clinton administration recommending creating safe havens for civilians in Bosnia. I'm wondering where you stand now on the question of what, if any, military intervention would be appropriate.
One of my objections to the American people's curiosity and the press's approach is that they always say, well, should we or should we not, or yes or no on this question or that. Unfortunately, I don't think many of these questions are quite that simple. To begin with, if we were to intervene in Bosnia, it has a very high political content. I don't believe that we should do anything like that unless we can find some consensus among the American people that they are willing to make a commitment and all of the commitment might involve. Frankly, I do not see that consensus right now, at least not among the bulk of the American people. And given the circumstances in Bosnia and all the arms that are there and the various factions, it is unlikely that we can go in there without a considerable effort and that we can go in there without harm coming to some of our own people. Now, the American people have to understand that if they're going to support this decision. Also, I see very little prospect for us solving these enmities. Even if we go in and stay, separate the combatants, and feed the hungry, ultimately, when we leave, these conflicts, disputes, rivalries are going to remain. They're still going to be there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Admiral William Crowe, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's written a new autobiography called The Line of Fire. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Admiral William Crowe is my guest. He's written a new autobiography called The Line of Fire. And one of the things you've been known for is a strong academic background, and you put your military career in jeopardy to go to Princeton University, where you studied political science. You also went to Stanford University. You say that there was a tremendous impact on your way of seeing things from studying at Princeton, that Princeton taught you freedom of thought. Is there a place for that kind of freedom of thought in the military?
Very definitely. And I also said in the book that the hardest thing we have to worry about, and also the most difficult, is to reward people that are free thinkers, because sometimes they're quite irritating and annoying. But when you get to high rank, being a free thinker with an open mind is terribly, terribly important. The problem in the military is that maybe not many people survive to high rank with open minds because of the hierarchical or the caste system that we use to keep our military disciplined and controlled and responsive. I consider that one of the prime problems.
Whether the military weeds out innovative thinking?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, was there a time when you felt pressured to leave or pressured not to speak your mind?
Well, excuse me, when I was told to write, along with a colleague of mine, a paper on the North Vietnamese violations of the peace accords. And we wrote a paper, and the more we studied it, we discovered that not only the North Vietnamese were violating the accords, that maybe the South and also the United States had had a little part in this. And when we wrote a balanced paper to that effect, that caused all kinds of problems, because the conventional party line was that the other guys had violated and we had not. I was under some pressure there.
What did you do?
We didn't back down. We just sort of procrastinated and turned out a softer paper, but we didn't back off our fundamental conclusion, and eventually the man that was so upset just quit worrying about it, and it went away.
I want you to explain the full job of the chair of the Joint Chiefs.
I don't know that we have enough time for that. But of course, what is principal job is as he's the senior military advisor to the president, to the National Security Council, and to the Secretary of Defense. He actually is not in the chain of command. Now, as a practical proposition, the Secretary of Defense usually says, well, I will transmit my orders through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs so that he can put them in a military format and have plenty of opportunity to agree, disagree, or advise me. But the fact remains that technically and formally, he is not in the chain of command. The commanders in the field sort of consider him in the chain of command, and they communicate their problems to the Secretary of Defense through the chairman. But I repeat, something that is not understood in the country normally is that the chairman is not in the chain, directly in the formal chain of command.
Did you get in the middle of power struggles between members of the cabinet, the president, the Pentagon?
I didn't get in between the president and the cabinet members. No, not at all. Of course, the Pentagon itself's got its own share of struggles for detailing to commands and promotions and issues, who's going to win the argument on new weapon systems and so forth. And there's no way you can avoid that.
Were there problems or competitions between George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger?
There were many arguments between them, and that I did observe firsthand.
Now, how did you figure into that?
Well, it depended on what the issue was. One of the main things I figured in, I didn't want to get in the argument, but Secretary Shultz felt that as a member of the National Security Council and Secretary of State, that he should have direct access to the senior military advisor. And Secretary Weinberger sort of thought that while he might have direct access, that he shouldn't have access without Secretary Weinberger being present. And that was a point of contention between them, and I naturally was caught in the middle of that.
How'd you resolve it?
Well, the first thing I did was get out of their way when they started stomping people into the ground. But I had been invited several times over to have breakfast with Secretary Shultz, and I would tell the Secretary of Defense that I was going to do this, and he could come if he'd like, and he would grumble a little bit and say no, he wouldn't come. But then as soon as I had that meeting, I'd run right back and tell the Secretary of Defense what we discussed, and pretty soon he got used to me going over there without him, and the issue just sort of faded away.
Now, one of your big concerns, of course, was nuclear policy. How well informed were Presidents Reagan and Bush when you served with them?
I think President Bush was, at least when he became president, was very well informed, and we went to great efforts to make sure that he was during the interim period between the election and the inauguration, and he was very cooperative in that regard, and he probably, I'd say this with some reservations because I'm not that close to some previous presidents, but I suspect he was the best informed of any president we'd had when he entered office. I don't really know about Reagan exactly because I was not there when he came into office, but I don't think he was as well informed as President Bush was on the details of the nuclear business.
What was for you the most tense moment of the Cold War?
When I was Commander-in-Chief Pacific, I was very heavily involved in the 007 shoot-down in Korea, in the Soviet Union, I mean. And I thought there were some moments out there when perhaps we were going to have confrontation we just didn't really want, but we were standing up pretty straight and tall, and we had some eyeball-to-eyeball things happen out there that were pretty dicey. Incidents like that, just a continuous succession of them. I thought probably the most important moment, and incidentally the chapter that I personally enjoy most in the book about Akhmayev, is that my standing up despite some opposition, for opening up a dialogue with Akhmayev, I thought that was fairly important.
You had a close dialogue with your counterpart in the Soviet Union, Marshal Sergei Akhmayev. He was the senior arms negotiator there.
He was, but he was the chief of general staff, but also the senior arms negotiator. Now, I was not in the arms control negotiations, but he was from the Russian standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, he killed himself. He hanged himself.
He was committed suicide.
This was after the failed Soviet coup.
Yes.
He was in on the coup, right?
No, I don't know, but I am told by many contacts in Russia that they really have no evidence that he was in on the coup. It was clear that after the coup that he didn't, I guess he didn't stand up and say, no, I'm against it or anything. I think by then he was terribly depressed. But he didn't, he was not involved in the coup, I don't think, although there is some controversy about it. I've even had other Russians tell me they didn't think he committed suicide.
That he was killed?
Yeah, but they didn't elaborate, and I have no idea what evidence they have for such a thing.
So here was somebody who you were proud that you were able to establish a relationship with, and then he commits suicide after the failed coup. What went through your mind?
Well, it was quite a blow. On the other hand, I had received several letters from him, and it was pretty clear to me in those letters that he was in a state of depression.
Over what?
He had signed on to Gorbachev early in the game. I think what he really wanted, in fact, he was rather candid about this with me. What he wanted was a kinder and gentler Soviet society. He didn't like a lot of the things that he had seen the regime do, and he didn't approve of sending people to Siberia. He didn't approve of shooting people. He didn't approve of making people have a identification card and a pass to do any traveling around the country. On the other hand, he was very much a firmly committed socialist and communist. But he thought Gorbachev was going to bring about a more tolerant, softer society, and he thought it was long overdue, and Gorbachev was the first leader that he'd had anything to do with that didn't have Stalinist baggage, and he signed on. Well, it got out of control, and it began very rapidly to go much faster downhill than Akhmayev had ever predicted. He wanted a better relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, and what he wanted was a 50-50 relationship, and they give and we give and they give. Well, he concluded very soon that it wasn't 50-50, it was about 9-1 in our favor, and that we wanted a free market economy and they were trying it. We wanted Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania free, and they broke away, and we wanted the Warsaw Pact to disappear, and all these things were happening. And he didn't think that was the kind of relationship that he wanted with the United States. Now, where he got into a problem is he thought that many of these things were happening because we engineered them. He could not bring himself to admit that many of those things were happening. We didn't have anything to do with it. It was just his own society falling apart and the communism had brought on itself. And he could never really bring himself to that admission. He was wrong, but, you know, that's what happens to people when they get those age. He told me one time, he said, it's extremely depressing for a man of my age to conclude that everything he worked and fought for 50 years is wrong. And then he said, and to think that you have to start over at my age, that is really depressing. He was 67 when he said that.
Admiral, now you are back in civilian life. You retired from the military. And now you're watching the military be somewhat scaled down. Less of a budget, bases closing. How do you feel about that?
I have a twinge. On the other hand, I feel, just as I did during the campaign, that we have to keep our eye on the main ball, and that's the fiscal health of the country, and that there's never been a better time in my life, mature life, for scaling down the military than right now, because I think we have, military's not our number one problem. Security's not our number one problem. But what I do, what does concern me, and I made this very clear in the book, is not the immediate drawdown and not the immediate scaling down of appropriations. It's what happens over time. The traditional American pattern in a protracted period of peace with no prominent threat on the horizon has been that Congress every year addresses the defense appropriation and said, well, nothing happened this year and we don't see any change in the international climate. So this year, let's cut back ammunition. And next year, let's cut back spare parts. And the next year, let's cut back fuel and sustainables. And pretty soon, they do that over a long period of time, and they don't put much money in modernization, and you've got hollow forces. And that really does distress me. And you've got to have a viable force if you're in an all-volunteer environment if you're going to attract good people. I don't think that anything we're going to do the next 2 or 3 years is going to disturb our military supremacy in the world, but over a period 4 or 5 and around the turn of the century, we better be very careful. There's a line below which we cannot go when spending money on the military. I don't know where it is exactly, but...
Are you glad that this period of downsizing is happening after you retired?
That's an unfair question. Of course, I knew it was going to happen when I retired. That was, the writing was on the wall. I mean, it was obvious that we were running a smaller military.
Is that part of the reason for your retirement?
I think it had a little to do with it. My age and my knees, and I was tired. I wanted to do other things, and also that was part of it.
Admiral, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Admiral William Crowe, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Presidents Bush and Reagan. He's written a new autobiography called The Line of Fire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.